May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
Good afternoon and welcome to Attention, Please. I'm Phil Andrus. KPTZ airs Attention, Please each week to draw your attention to the good work being done to deepen our sense of community and strengthen our resilience here on the Olympic Peninsula, where we all live. The topic of today's Attention, Please is a project of the Jefferson County Historical Society titled Chinese American Voices, which begins on Friday, the 4th of February. With me are Tara McCauley, Director of Education and Public Programs for the Historical Society, Tessa Halls, who is the presenter on February 4th, and Valerie So, whose presentation is on March 4th. There is another presentation in April. We're not going to talk about that today. So, Tara, with the museum closed until March, what is there going to be other than the first Friday presentations, which are across the street, more or less across the street? What is there going to be until you open, and then after you open, will there be an exhibit?
Yes. So things are very busy at the museum. We're replacing the front doors. We're installing two new exhibits. One is a celebration of woodworking here in Jefferson County, and another talks about our new exhibit project. We're reimagining all of our historical exhibits. And so we have an exhibit sort of talking about that project and inviting people to get involved. So there'll be a lot to see in March when we open. And then we're doing this great speaker series.
With respect to Chinese American Voices, will there be an exhibit?
Not right away. Some of the content and relationships that we're building with this series will help inform our new exhibition project. But we'll be developing that content for some time still.
Okay. And Chinese American Voices, the presentations will be virtual. Will they be in person or both?
Both. So our February event is virtual only, so it'll be live streamed. And currently our plan is for our March and April event to be a hybrid. So we'll have both some in-person attendance opportunities, and it will be live streamed and available to watch virtually.
And for more information, all these details, how to participate, how to attend, the website is the place to go, I believe.
It is indeed, jchsmuseum.org.
And if you missed that, write to me at cats@kptz.org. Tessa Hulls. I got lost in Tessa Hulls' website, and I did come out, but I liked it so much, I went back, and then I went back again. Says Rich Smith of The Stranger, a newspaper out of Seattle, Tessa Hulls is a writer, a performer, an extreme biker with an intense case of wanderlust. I've paraphrased that a little bit and stumbled over some of it. What we're going to see of Tessa is a thumbnail of a snapshot of a snapshot. We're only going to get just a little bit, but we're going to get as much as we have time for. We have here in our community, and Tessa, I hope you get to meet Nett Nichols. She is a graphic artist, and she has introduced me to what graphic art actually means. She draws for the Port Townsend Leader. Why do you choose this as your medium, graphic art? I could call it cartoons. I could call it comics. Nat would correct me, and maybe you will as well.
Well, thanks so much for having me first off. And actually, Nat and I met when I first moved to Port Townsend, because on paper, we're pretty much the same person, female mountain bikers doing graphic novels involving interviews and history. I personally love comics, and I don't think they're pejorative. I'm fine with that term, because it's kind of a sneak attack way to make people learn. You can lull them into a sense of accessibility while also having a lot of density of information. And I choose that medium because it's a really great way to convey information and sort of shift between the microcosm and the macrocosm of complex stories.
And you live in Port Townsend?
I do. I actually recently moved back to Seattle. In a surprising plot twist, two other artist friends and I pooled our resources and co-bought a house. But I moved to Port Townsend to work on this book, and basically drew 99% of it while living there.
So you have it nearly complete. This book is titled Feeding Ghosts, which is the title of your presentation. A graphic memoir artist talk is your presentation. So this is the story of you and your family. What is the story? And you can have to use words here because we're on the radio. We cannot see the pictures. What is the story starting in China, the story of your family, and why is it compelling for you?
Well, the short answer when people ask me what my book is about is down to two words. It's about complicated mothers. But the slightly more fleshed out version is that my grandmother Sun Yi was a journalist in Shanghai during the communist takeover. And she ended up having a brief fling with a Swiss diplomat who left and went back to Switzerland before my mom was born. So my mom never met her father. And because my grandmother wrote for pro-nationalist newspapers, she was labeled a political dissident and was basically a single mother raising a mixed race bastard child while being persecuted and put through Maoist era thought reform campaigns. Eventually, they were able to flee China as refugees. They got out at the tail end of 1957, just before the Great Leap Forward. And once they arrived there, my grandmother wrote a memoir titled 8 Years in Red Shanghai, Love, Starvation, Persecution. And because there was so much thirst for information coming from behind the bamboo curtain, it became an immediate bestseller in Hong Kong and Taiwan. So my grandma was able to use the proceeds from that first print run to put my mom into a really elite Hong Kong boarding school. And then the instant my mom was safe, my grandma, who had been struggling with mental illness, had a psychotic breakdown and ended up institutionalized in Hong Kong's first psychiatric hospital. So at that point, my mom was taken on as a charity case by her school and was essentially raised as an orphan by this colonial boarding school. So my book is about all of that, which is why I've been working on it for the better part of a decade. And I actually just turned in a draft to my editor yesterday. So the end is in sight. It's basically looking at the ways in which we carry our parents' history with us. And it's giving a crash course, because again, the sneak attack of comics being really great educational tools. It's going over about a century of really tumultuous Chinese history that's covered in my grandma's story.
And the book that your grandmother wrote, was that translated into English?
It never was. Part of the process and part of why this has taken me so long is I've had to get funding for various parts of it. So I did get a grant to have an English translation, but that's something that's just kind of been for internal use.
I would love to read the book, actually, and I hope it is someday translated. It must be quite a story. Around the dining room table when you were growing up, who typically would be there?
Well, I grew up in Northern California in a really small town on the coast, and it was just, you know, me, my mom, my dad, my brother, and my grandma. So pretty isolated. You know, it was a town of 350. There were no other Asian American families. And so even though this was a story within my own family, I really didn't know much of that history. So that's been a huge part of the process, is just really learning the broader context of my grandmother's life.
And who told you the story? Your grandmother, I suppose, somewhat. Your mother, I would imagine, more so.
Well, not my grandmother at all, actually, because my mom didn't teach me Chinese. And at this point, I've clawed my way back to being able to, you know, order noodles and ask for directions. But between that language barrier and the fact that my grandma was always really heavily medicated on antipsychotics, we had no way to communicate. So this book is, in many respects, it's an attempt to have a conversation with my grandmother that was impossible while she was still alive.
Huh. So you actually only knew her mostly by watching her and by knowing of her experiences from your mother.
Yeah. And as to the specifics of those experiences, I really didn't know much. And so that's what has been so fascinating about getting this translation of my grandma's memoir and seeing that the inflection points of her life story line up with all of these really momentous, tumultuous periods of Chinese history. You know, it's she was having this romance as Shanghai was falling under communist rule. That began only a few months before Mao declared the People's Republic of China. And it just kind of keeps going from there. So I'm essentially using the timeline of my grandma's story to teach all of this history.
She must have been a remarkable woman.
She must have, but I was never able to communicate with her. So who knows?
Your mother would know, I suppose. Is she still living?
She is, yeah.
Okay. The small town in Northern California where you grew up, what was the name of it?
Point Reyes.
How did the family end up in such a place as that?
Interesting trajectory. So my dad's also an immigrant, but my dad was born in London. So my parents are both from these huge metropolitan international cities and ended up in a town of 350. My mom kind of translated her trauma into a lot of religious and spiritual seeking. So she had ended up following a church community out there. And my dad at that point was kind of a semi-professional glider bum. So he was chasing thurbles, and that's how he ended up there. And they met and stayed.
And the work that they have done in their lives, I'm curious about what sort of people your parents are.
My mom spent her career as a special education teacher. You know, she was always very stable and concerned with stability, I think probably given the way that she grew up. And my dad, if anything, if we'd call him an unlicensed aerodynamics engineer.
I asked you about your dining room table. Who sat around the table? You left that table when you were 17. I'm wondering why you left and where did you go?
I had a pretty complicated relationship with my family, and I was really hungry for the outside world. And I think growing up in a small town with immigrant parents, you know, culture is essentially what you take for granted. And I never really had that sense of taking America for granted, because the way that I was raised within my family was in so much constant contradiction. And so I think it kind of made me a permanent sociologist. And I really just wanted to go get my own sense of what this country was. So kind of along the way, I fell in love with long distance bike travel and biked solo from Southern California to Maine, just trying to gain a deeper sense of what the American Deep South was like. Ended up in Antarctica, Alaska, really, yes, a lot of wanderlust.
A lot of wanderlust indeed. How did you learn to be a graphic artist? Looking at your work, it's extremely detailed. A person has to spend a goodly amount of time with each single panel. So you have a style. How did you learn? How did the style develop, and how did you learn to do this kind of work?
I mean, I feel really lucky to have always known what I was supposed to do with my life. I was one of those kids where basically from the instant I could shove a crayon in my nose, it was clear I was going to spend my life as an artist and writer. So I wouldn't say that I ever really learned. It's just I never did anything else.
Huh, so you were doodling in class.
Yeah. And eventually my teachers gave up on trying to get me to stop. And I think, I've been vindicated.
So describe the presentation you're going to give on Friday, February 4th. What are we going to be, what will we see? What will we hear? From what I've read of you, you have a bit of performance art about you as well.
Yeah, I do a lot of presentations. Some people have said what I do is essentially history-based illustrated stand-up comedy, because I do work with a lot of subjects that are really heavy, and I really believe in the importance of keeping things funny. So I'm going to be giving a crash course on the content of what's in Feeding Ghosts. I'll be reading from some of the finished sections. Yeah, it's basically, it'll be walking the viewers through what this book is.
You're biracial. So how has that informed you? How will we see that shine in your presentation on Friday?
I think it's a particularly interesting moment where our culture is really driving us towards flat and simple binaries to not be able to fall into that. And I think, again, as I mentioned earlier, this sort of being a constant sociologist, I think being biracial and being both and, but also neither, really makes me very drawn to the gray area and things that don't necessarily have clean answers. So I think that carries through in every thread of what I do, is this sense of any piece of information belongs to a complex entwined web, and there never are clear categories.
So you turned your book over to your publisher or editor, I forget what you said. But anyway, you're just about ready to move on to your next project.
I turned in a draft. I will be well and truly free with final prints to galleys this July.
Okay. I don't need to reword the question. You still know what it is. What's next for you?
I'm going to sleep for about a month. I think, I'm working 14-hour days right now to pull off this deadline. So I don't know. I think I'm going to have quite an existential crisis because I've been working on this for 7 years. But I would really like to be able to work on something that contains more joy than this project, because it is very heavy. But, you know, I think the threads of what I do are pretty well established. I like working with buried or forgotten histories and bringing to light information that might seem dry or esoteric, but doing it in a dynamic and accessible way. So I'm just excited to be able to say yes to things again.
Okay, Tessa Hulse, thank you very much for our conversation. Our listeners can see Tessa Hulse in presentation on the 4th of February. Tara, remind me where she can be seen.
Yeah, so this presentation will be live streamed, and folks can register to get that link. The easiest place to go is our website, jchsmuseum.org. Look for the First Friday speaker series, and then there's a link to our Symbolix website.
Very well. Tessa, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And I'm looking forward to actually seeing you as a stand-up comic, with a stand-up comic with comics. Is what I guess I'll call it. Valerie So is an associate professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. Since 1986, her experimental videos, installations, and documentary films have won dozens of awards, grants, and commissions, and have been exhibited at venues such as the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, the Museum of Modern Art, and the New Museum in New York City. She earned her MFA from the Arts Institute of Chicago in video and photography, and her bachelor's from the University of California at Los Angeles in art. Her research topics are Asian American film, history, and culture. And the topic, part of the topic, probably a broader topic than this says, is Chinese gardens, which is a place here in Port Townsend.
Yes.
Valerie.
And actually, I'm a full professor now. I got promoted. I don't know when that bio was from. But yes, I always say that because my mom, when I got tenure and I became an associate, she said, aren't you supposed to be a full professor? It's like, Mom, why?
Well, tell your mother and yourself, congratulations.
Thank you.
And yes. Tell yourself also that your website needs a little updating because that's...
Oh, no. I don't even know which website that's from.
Oh, I don't. It might not even have been yours, I guess.
Okay, no worries. I'll look and see. I'm going to search this because I'm going to clean that information out of every location I can find.
Well, you pop up quite frequently on the internet, so you're going to have a little bit of work ahead of you.
Oh.
A bit of searching. At any rate, how did you learn about Chinese gardens?
Well, this is actually really funny. I had a residency at Centrum way back in the late 90s, right? And I was there for a month. Centrum is really great. And I'm sure you guys all know about that in Port Townsend. And so I was just wandering around, as a person does when they're at Centrum, outside and enjoying the nice nature. And I came across this plaque, which I don't think is even there anymore. It said something like, this is the Chinese gardens. This is where the Chinese used to grow vegetables to sell in Port Townsend. And it's right, it's like near the marsh area where I want to say there might be even a small pond or something near there. And so I thought, what the heck? Because when I was wandering around Port Townsend back in the 90s, I mean, there were very few Asian people there, like maybe none or two or three. So I wanted to know what happened. So I investigated. I decided I would figure out what happened to all these Chinese people that used to be there. Luckily, the Jefferson County Historical Society has a whole archive about the Chinese community that used to be in Port Townsend up until, I would say, the very early 20th century. And so, yeah, so it was great. I used that resource and I found out about it. And then I want to say, came back to that project maybe 10 or 12 years later. In the interim, I had two children, so I didn't really make a lot of movies at that point. And then I visited Port Townsend again, and I shot the footage that I wanted to supplement the story, and I completed, I believe, in 2013.
So do you come to film first or to history first?
I'm a filmmaker, yeah. So the history was just sort of incidental, and it just was fortuitous that I was, you know, at Centrum and that plaque was there, which apparently is no longer there. I think what happened in 2008 during the financial crisis, someone stole it for the medal. Is what I was told.
Probably was bronze, and that probably is pretty...
It was bronzed.
Pretty valuable. How are you going to incorporate your film into your presentation on March 4th?
I believe that we're going to screen it, and I'm coming up in person, which is really great because I do love Port Townsend quite a bit. I'll be driving up from Seattle, flying in from San Francisco, and then driving up.
So it will be a screening of your film and then a Q&A.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe so. And I have, you know, some other short projects that I will probably also show.
At its greatest, what was the approximate Chinese population in Port Townsend and Jefferson County? And this would have been around the turn of the 20th century, I suppose.
Yeah, I'd say like late 1800s, early 20th century. I think I read that at one point, one out of four people in Port Townsend was Chinese. So, you know, out of a population of maybe 2,000 or something tiny like that. But still, that's substantial, right? And there was a little Chinatown, which still has, there's remnants still. I want to say there's a few storefronts that are still named after Chinese folks.
And how well received were the Chinese people? How safe was it to be Chinese in Port Townsend in those days?
Well, that's the thing. It was during that time, the late 1800s, where there was a lot of anti-Chinese violence. And up and down the entire West Coast, you know, some of it was pretty extreme, like people were killed. Of course, Seattle, they ran out their entire Chinese population. Tacoma, same. They put them on barges and shipped them to San Francisco, I think. Interestingly enough, Port Townsend's Chinese American history is not quite as violent. However, what I discovered was that the downtown burned down, I think maybe 1904, or caught fire. There was a fire in downtown. And Chinatown was part of that. And the firemen let the Chinese buildings burn down. you know, fortuitous, inadvertent, whatever you want to call it, you know, but at that point, most of the Chinese moved out.
Before they moved out and before their buildings were burned, what did they do for their livelihoods?
Well, you know, they sold those vegetables they grew in the Chinese gardens. I'm sure there were shopkeepers and restaurants and probably laundries. Maybe some less licit, you know, maybe some slightly illegal activities, maybe gambling and brothels. Although, probably.
The next question is, how did they come to Port Townsend and why did they come to Port Townsend? Why did they want to settle here?
This is another funny thing, too. So Port Townsend is pretty close to the Canada border, right? Canadian border. And in 1882, there was the Chinese Exclusion Act. And so legal immigration from China was stopped, but you could go through Canada. So a lot of Chinese would go through Canada and then sneak across the border to Port Townsend, because Port Townsend was a big shipping town at that point. Apparently, at one point, I read that Port Townsend was supposed to be the capital of Washington State, but then the railroads bypassed Port Townsend, it became Seattle instead. So the funny thing about this is just talked about in the film is that a lot of Chinese worked at the Chinese gardens, let's say 40 or 50 people at a time. So people would sneak across the border. They would go and work at the Chinese gardens, and then they would move to Seattle or San Francisco or whatever. They moved to their next big town. But they pretended to be the same people working there. That same 40 number of people still pretended to be working there, but they were always like different people going through because, you know, the white residents of Port Townsend didn't look too closely at the Chinese guys. They just thought they were all the same guys. So it was a way to get around the Chinese Exclusion Act by sneaking across the border, pretending to be somebody else, and then, you know, going on.
So basically what you're saying is folks would look at a Chinese person and the Chinese person would look like every other Chinese person.
They would say, oh, that's that Chan guy, isn't it? And they say, oh, yeah, I'm that Chan guy.
So one can walk down Water Street today, I think probably even on this very day today, and may encounter a person of Asian descent, probably a tourist from somewhere across the water. But 100 and some years ago, it would have been one in four.
One in four, yeah. I want to say, there's something called Zetai, right? Zetai trading or something that still exists? Yeah, there's a building that says Zetai. I took some pictures of contemporary buildings that are still there. So there's a few, yeah.
So when the buildings were burned, when their livelihood was gone, and they had to leave, many of them would have gone back to Canada. But where else did they? Did they go back to China?
I don't think they went back to Canada. I think they went to Seattle or San Francisco or something. I don't think they went back to China. Originally, a lot of Chinese immigrants had the fantasy that they would move back to China. And, you know, they would make a lot of money in the U.S. and then they would go back to China. But very, very few people did that. So I feel like, yeah, I actually traced a family, a person whose family did live in Port Townsend, who now lives in Seattle, and I interviewed her in the film. And her family did move to Seattle. Uh-huh. So that was kind of interesting. But she, you know, she walked me down the street. She said, that's where our shop was. You know, here's a picture of my grandfather walking down Water Street. So it was pretty amazing.
So you make,
and a lot of this was from the Jefferson County Historical Society records.
Maybe where this information came from as well, on one of the many websites, and mind you, I can't cite them. I guess I should probably footnote these conversations, but today I'm not going to. There was reference to there being lynchings of Chinese people in Jefferson County. Mm.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. I think where are the places we went to? There were some pretty close by. I can't remember the exact names of the towns, but it's in the film. There are a few, not within Port Townsend itself, but pretty closely, like within, you know, a pretty close proximity.
Within Jefferson County, then?
I feel like it was within Jefferson County, yeah, because I think we drove to them.
When I think of lynchings, I think of lynchings of African-American people in the Southeast. Mm-hmm. So I was not cognizant of there being lynchings of Asians, probably Chinese and Japanese, throughout the West.
Yeah, there's an entire book written called Driven Out, which is, I think it documents more than 150 cases of anti-Chinese violence up and down the coast during that time. And it was pretty extreme. Like I said, some people were definitely killed, and there was definitely large numbers of people who were forced to relocate.
So your film Chinese Gardens was released when?
I think it was 2013.
Yeah, so long enough
ago.
Almost
10 years ago.
I should have known about it, but I didn't. How can I see it? I mean, I can see it by coming to the presentation.
Sure.
But beyond that, how can our listeners who may not be able to attend the presentation see it?
There's a couple different ways. The Historical Society will have the film available to screen for, I think, about 6 months during the run of, for about 6 months. Or you can watch it online. I could probably send you the link. It's, you know, you could just search the Chinese Gardens by Valerie So. And it's like, you know, it's one of those on-demand things. So you have to pay a little bit, like $5 or something.
I think we can manage the $5.
Yeah.
How long
you
is
can
it?
Buy a DVD if you want, if you have a DVD player.
I think that we do, actually, in my house.
Oh, well, there you go.
There we
go. Well,
you
know, it did show at the Port Townsend Film Festival probably a year or so after it came out, which is so fun. What a great film festival that is. So sweet.
So I asked Tessa, and I will ask you, a little different in this case, because the film was released 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago. So what have you worked on in the meantime, films that you have made since Chinese Gardens?
Sure. Well, you know, I made a documentary feature about called Love Boat Taiwan, which is all about this summer program in Taiwan that Chinese American and Taiwanese American kids go on, and college kids, and they basically have a lot of fun and hook up with each other. And then I'm now working on a project about the Auntie Sewing Squad, which I was a member of last year. And we were a group of sewists who made face masks, cloth face masks, and donated them to vulnerable communities across the U.S. because the government did a terrible job with mitigating the COVID crisis. So we felt like we had to step in and do something. So I think we had about 800 members, and we donated 350,000 masks.
That number again, please.
About 800 members and about 350,000 hand-sewn masks were donated.
Is this film available also to see?
That one I'm working on right now. I have a couple shorts that I made, short documentaries that I made, that maybe I'll show those also when I come out in March. You can also stream those as well.
So, Valerie, so your presentation is March 4th. We'll get one last comment from Tara. More details for people so they will be able to find Valerie and Tessa when they make their presentations. How, again, can we see them, Tara?
All the information is on our website, jchsmuseum.org. There's a link to where you can register. Again, our February 4th event is live streamed only, so you can register and you'll receive that live stream link. We also will be recording these presentations, so everyone who registers gets a link to the recording and can watch it at their leisure. And then for our March 4th event with Valerie, that'll be currently, we're planning to have that be a hybrid event when we have some in-person attendance available, as well as it will be live streamed as well and recorded.
So we're hoping, and those of us who pray are praying, and those of us hoping that by March, Omicron will have subsided and we can at least in a limited way get together again.
Yes, exactly.
I want to thank all of you. I want to thank Tara McCauley first. I want to thank Tessa Halls. I wish I would have met you around town. I maybe have passed you on my bicycle, but since I didn't know you, I didn't wave at you, but consider yourself waved at from now on. And Valerie, so a pleasure to meet you too.
Thank you so much, and I hope to see you when I'm in town.
You know, let's make sure that happens. Next week on Attention Please, I will be interviewing two people from the Far Reaches Botanical Conservatory, a very interesting organization right here in Port Townsend that I had not heard about until they wrote me an email. So next week on Attention Please, that will be the topic. This has been Attention Please. I'm Phil Andrus, and bye now.